I encourage you to take your Bibles tonight. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 will be the first passage that we'll be looking at tonight in our study. And while you're turning to that passage, let me just thank you so very much for your presence tonight. I hope that you have had a good Monday. That may seem like an oxymoron, but hopefully your week has gotten off to a good start, and we appreciate so much your presence here tonight, and hope that as we study together that we'll be challenged in the things that God has to say to us, especially in regard, of course, to the topic that Terry's mentioned, the point of pain. Whoever came up with this idea that life is just a rose garden filled with rainbows and lollipops, they certainly missed the boat on that one, didn't they? It seems that no matter how hard you try to protect and insulate your private world, there is always going to be someone or something that is going to find a way of messing that up. Even Jesus himself was not immune to trouble, and therefore do we honestly believe that somehow you and I are going to be able to escape it? Trouble comes really in a variety of forms, doesn't it? Family and friends, job and school, economics and education. It comes in the form of criticism and disease, illness and death. Trials are just the way that it is in life. And if you think that you're the only one that has difficulties in life, then you're not paying attention to the people who are around you. The Bible teaches us that if our Christianity is real, if our faith is mature, then it is going to reveal itself in times of pain and difficulty. That if our faith is no good in times of trouble, then it's no good. That if it's only good when we don't need it, then the reality is that we don't need it. That if Christianity only works when we're doing well, then what good is it? We've all encountered pain and trials in life. We've all been suddenly faced with circumstances that we never expected and certainly never would have chosen. Gordon MacDonald, in his book, The Life God Blesses, he refers to them as disruptive moments. That's kind of a nice, polite way of putting it, isn't it? And this is what he had to say. He said, disruptive moments are those unanticipated events, most of which one would usually have chosen to avoid had it been possible. We don't like disruptive moments. They are too often associated with pain and inconvenience, failure and humiliation. Not that they have to be, but that seems to be the human condition. And yet, in light of the fact that pain is such a common part of our life, I think few of us ever fully grasp the fact that in the life of a Christian, there is no such thing as pointless pain. Suffering is the refiner's fire that works to purify in us the gold of character, of deep faith, of abiding wisdom. While we would certainly choose a simpler and definitely a much more comfortable process, the fact of the matter is life doesn't play out that way. That everything worthwhile in life comes at a price. And when it comes to maturity, oftentimes that price is pain. It is mature faith that is able to hold on to God's love for us. It is mature faith that continues to trust that His purposes are not only right, but that they are always for our ultimate good. Now tonight it would be both foolish and futile to trying to come up with a definitive answer to the question of suffering. The book that many people think of as the textbook on suffering, the book of Job, in all of its 42 chapters, does not provide us with really any explanation in terms of the question, why? And yet, with that said, that's not to mean that there's not some answers that are provided to us. The Bible does supply us with some nuggets of truth on this very important subject that can help us to look beneath the surface of suffering and become keenly aware of the fact that there genuinely is a point to pain. I hope your Bibles are open. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and let's start our reading in verse 16. He writes, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison." If you're into highlighting or underlining words in your Bible, notice the two small, simple, yet powerful words, "for us." It is producing for us. Now, when it comes to holding on to God in adversity, there are a number of examples that we could obviously turn to. We could look at Abraham and Sarah, that difficult time of waiting for the arrival of Isaac. We could look at Joseph and the trials that he endured with brothers who hated him, selling him into slavery, and of course then being falsely accused, imprisoned, and spending so much time in difficulty, and yet in the end we see the benefits that were brought as a result of that. We could study the life of Moses and see all of the frustrations and the challenges that he faced with a grumbling, murmuring, complaining people that he sought to lead from the land of bondage to a land of promise. We could look at David and the time, the decade that he spent running from Saul, who was trying to take his life. We could look at Jeremiah and the difficulties that he faced while he was dealing with the wayward nation of Judah. But tonight what I want us to do is I want us instead to focus on three New Testament passages, all of them I think very familiar to us, or at least to most of us, that equate maturity with the experiences of suffering. That if we're going to become mature, if we're going to grow, then it's going to come in many cases through the avenue of suffering. Let's start in James chapter 1. James chapter 1, again, a very familiar passage to many of us in regard to trials. James says in James chapter 1, starting in verse 2, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." You'll notice James, first of all, says that it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. When you encounter trials. Trials are not optional equipment in the life of a Christian. They are the standard rule. He says they are various trials. It is a word in the Greek that means variegated, many colors. And the point that James is making here is not that we'll encounter many trials, though that may be true. His point is that we'll face all kinds of trials, that they'll come in different shapes and colors, that they'll take on a variety of forms and faces. Though some translations render it with the word temptation, a trial really is the word that fits the context of what James has in mind. James, in verse 2, he's not talking about solicitations to do evil. What he is talking about is difficulties that disrupt the pattern of tranquility and peace and happiness in our lives, and therefore, as a result, test our faith. Every trial that comes into your life and mine, whether it's big or whether it's small, is ultimately a test that we are going to pass or we're going to fail. And our response during those trials is going to determine, or at least reveal, who or what we are actually trusting in, what in reality we are depending upon. James says if we're to gain the most from our trials, we will receive them with an attitude of joy. Joy from a trial? No, joy from an anticipation of what God is going to do in us as a result of that trial. Our joy is rooted in our ability to see beyond the pain and to focus our attention on the benefits that are ultimately going to come because of it. I turn back a page or two. It's just one page in my Bible. It may be more in yours. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Notice what is said about Jesus in verse 2. Hebrews 12 and verse 2, "Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. What's the Hebrew writer saying? The Hebrew writer is telling us that Jesus kept his eyes on the finish line, that he stayed focused on the prize, that he didn't set his sights on the cross, but he looked beyond the cross, what the suffering was ultimately going to result in. Paul says a very similar thing in Romans 8 and verse 18 when he writes, "For I consider the suffering of this present time, the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." Now, go back to James 1, if you would. And I want you to notice that in verse 3, James builds on this theme with the very first word, at least in the New American Standard, in verse 3, and it's the word knowing. James reminds his readers of what they should have already understood. And that is that what is happening to them is not intended to hurt them. It is not intended to hinder them. It is intended to help them. That trials produce endurance in us. They produce a staying power, a tenacity that holds on under pressure. Skip down to verse 12 of the same chapter. Notice what James says there. He writes, "Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." Joy doesn't come as a result of being free from conflict. It comes as a result of fighting through it and winning in the end. Not from us being a spectator to other people's difficulties, but being participants in our own difficulties. One writer put it this way. He said, "The child of light is sometimes found walking in darkness, but he goes on walking." Not with a grit our teeth or just a kind of a suck it up kind of endurance. He's not referring to passive resignation. He's not speaking of merely surviving the trial. He's talking about a patient, triumphant perseverance that is the result of a demonstration of our love for God. James says that's who receives the crown. The Christian is not just someone who at some point in their life happened to believe in Jesus. James said it is someone who even in the face of life's challenges holds fast to what he has come to believe and the one that he has come to love. Now, with that said, endurance, James goes on in verse 4, he tells us there that endurance is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is what endurance is attempting to accomplish in us. And that's maturity. And he uses a couple of interesting words here. At first, the word perfect. The word in the Greek was used to describe a full-grown animal or fruit that was fully developed. I turned 50 a few years ago. One of the things that I wanted to do, my wife said, "What do you want to do for your 50th birthday?" I said, "Well, I want to go back. I was born in Pennsylvania." Yeah, I know it. Some of you are already, I know you native Texans, how you're thinking already. You just tuned me out right there. And there was, I grew up in Northwestern, or at least till I was 12 till we moved to Florida, but along Lake Erie is a particular stretch of land that the climate is right, the soil is right, ideal for growing Concord grapes. Chances are good that the grape juice that we partook of yesterday, Concord grapes, pretty good that it was grown in that region of our country. It's where Welch's was eventually based. I think they've been bought out now, but that's where all of that. So I wanted to go back and all of that said about grapes to the cherry festival. There was this big festival that I remember as a kid, and when I went back, it was a lot less than what I remember as a kid. That was what I wanted to do for my 50th birthday. I was the one who asked for it. My wife said, "We'll do it." And it was a disappointment. But we're riding along in the car, and she said, looking at the grapes, "Well, there's no grapes on there." I said, "Yeah, there's grapes on there." She says, "There's no grapes on there." I said, "Yeah." So I pulled the car over to the side. We got out. We walked up. And the vines are loaded with green grapes. Now, those little green orbs, they're a grape. And they're never going to become more of a grape than what they are at that particular moment in time. They're just not perfect. They're not mature. They're not ripe. And given the right amount of time and the right amount of rain and the right weather conditions, they, as we were there in July, by the time you get into the end of August and September, they now begin to ripen, they begin to change color, they begin to sweeten, and as a result of being ripe, they now become useful. That gives you an idea of the word. What trials produce, I was going to say ripe Christians. That may not be the best way to put that. It produces mature Christians. The word complete. We get our word holograph from that Greek word there, a three-dimensional picture. And so what James says is, I want you to consider it joy when you encounter, not if, but when, you encounter those wide array of trials, because you know that it is going to produce something good in you, endurance, but endurance is not the end of the road. Endurance only leads you to maturity, to be perfect and complete, to be well-rounded, fully put together as a Christian. I turn from there to 2 Corinthians chapter 12. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, and this, for many of us, another familiar section of Scripture. Paul begins, let's start our reading in verse 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7, Paul says, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me and to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I implored the Lord three times that it might leave me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I would rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. You'll notice here that Paul also begins with what he knows about the trial. And what he knows is that the purpose of the trial is to protect him from the sin of pride. Paul had been blessed with a rather remarkable experience. Back in verse 2, he mentions there that he had been caught up into what he describes there as the third heaven, something that had been granted to no other person. And as a result of that, Paul could have viewed that very unique privilege in a very proud manner. Paul could have marketed himself as the one man who visited heaven and was still alive to talk about it. Now, in our day, what Paul would have done, I don't think Paul would have done it, what other people have done is they go out and they write a bunch of books, don't they? And they sell a bunch of things that ends up then being a hoax later on. It is interesting to me that Paul said, these are things that humans shouldn't even speak. Paul didn't even talk about it, except here. And when he talks about it in the context of suffering that was intended to keep him humble about it, to keep things in perspective. And he describes this as a thorn in the flesh. Scholars have spent a lot of ink over the centuries speculating about what this thorn in the flesh might be. Some suggest that Paul had eye problems. Others that Paul was suffering from epilepsy or that he suffered from malaria. Some suggest that the thorn in the flesh was the sorrow that he felt over persecuting Christians. I don't know what the thorn was. What I do know is that the word that he uses here is a word that can also mean stake, S-T-A-K-E. And therefore, this picture is not of, you know, Paul receiving like you pick up a stem of a rose and you get poked in the finger. That the image here is of God allowing Satan to drive a stake into his flesh. Clearly, God did not think the specific identity of the thorn was important. And I think it's very providential that we don't know what the thorn is. Because what it does is it allows you and me to identify better with Paul, that we can plug whatever we're experiencing in our lives, and plug that into Paul's experience, that's our thorn in the flesh, whatever personal difficulty it might be, and understand that if God's grace was sufficient for Paul's thorn in the flesh, then God's grace is sufficient for mine. Paul didn't relish this painful experience any more than we would. In fact, he tells us here in the text that he asked God on three occasions to remove it. And God said, I'm not going to do that. But what I am going to do, Paul, is I am going to give you the grace that is necessary to continue in your preaching work in spite of the thorn in the flesh. I'm going to provide you the grace to keep going. And so Paul goes on in the text to tell us that in contradiction to human logic, he came to understand strength in the midst of weakness, power in the face of pain. And that's why Paul glorified God in the midst of this experience. Paul looks at himself and he says, I'm not the same man that I used to be. Understand, Paul, he experienced more than his fair share of pain, didn't he? But when it came to this thorn in the flesh, Paul said, I found within myself an inner depth, a spiritual maturity as a result of this suffering that I never would have experienced any other way. Turn from there to the book of Hebrews, chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And here we find another passage. It's a little different terminology that's used here, different imagery that is portrayed, but the same general idea in terms of trials or difficulties in life. Hebrews chapter 12, let's start our reading. I've got verse 5 on the screen. Let's actually back up a verse to verse 4. He says, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good so that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful, yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. When we are in the midst of prosperity, I think it's difficult for us to really get our hands around the concept of being a child of God. But when we're helpless, when we're wounded, when we're hurting, I think it becomes far more real to us. God is my Father. And the promise of God is that He will always be there for His children. He always has, and He always will be. And often, that presence is emphasized in a context of suffering, that there's little training that takes place, that there's little learning that is experienced without pain being a part of the process. The writer, in fact, says here that if there is no discipline, there is ultimately no growth. And the Bible never tells us that it should be eagerly anticipated. It acknowledges that when we are enduring it, he says here, it is not joyful but sorrowful. There are few of us who, when our parents were disciplining us, when you received that spanking, as many as I did, that I jumped up and down and I thanked my mom and dad for doing that for me. But I tell you what, years later, I'm thankful that they did that. It wasn't pleasant at the moment, but it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be beneficial for me long term. And that's what we see here. The Bible constantly reminds us to understand that's not the end of the story. In verse 10, it is for our good, our profit, our benefit, even when to us it appears to be anything but that. That just like our earthly parents discipline their children so that they will mature and grow up properly, God disciplines us so that we will mature and might share His holiness, is how the writer puts it. In the midst of difficulties, we can riddle ourselves with why questions. Why did this happen to me? Why am I going through this? Why did God allow this to happen? But you'll notice that the Hebrew writer says that our response ought to be to allow ourselves to be trained by it, that no matter how sharp the bend in the road, no matter how painful the moment, to understand that everything that's happening is for the eternal purposes of God, that He's trying to teach us some things that we couldn't learn in any other way. Last night I mentioned that I'm retired from Publix supermarkets. I told you a little bit of the story. I had set my goal to be a store manager at the time I had 10 years with the company. Started when I was 16. So by the time I was 26, I wanted to have my own store. 7.5 years, I was promoted to assistant store manager. I was well on my way to my goal. Let me pause for just a second and let you know that that was my ultimate goal. Now, I was a Christian, but I wasn't a good one. My job was my priority. That was the one thing that I wanted more than anything else in my life, was to reach that goal of being a store manager. Well, I'm a slow learner. So God said, all right, here, you have it. So He didn't give me a store manager's position, but He gave me the next step up. He gave me assistant store manager position. And in 1 week of that job, I was utterly miserable. I went from working 40, 50 hours a week to working 80, 90 hours a week. And Bev threw a party for me to celebrate my promotion, invited some people over from church. And when everybody left, she looked at me and she said, what is your problem? You act like you lost your best friend. I just looked at her. I said, I hate it. Spent the next year in utter, absolute misery. Every day I got up to go to work, I hated it. Hated it. Looked for jobs, couldn't find anything. Nothing would open up. People would talk to me, but they'd say, we can't hire you because you're connected to Publix and they're our biggest customer in Florida, and we don't want to have the illusion that we're stealing their people. I said, well, you know, can you promise me a job? No, we can't do that. Had 4 interviews with Frito-Lay. If you're not working for Publix, come talk to us. You promise me a job? Oh, we can't do that. I've got a wife and 2 little kids. I'm not leaving a job I've got for one that isn't promised to me. So I ended up riding it out. 8 years into it, I'm utterly miserable. Spent an entire year of utter, absolute misery. But during that year, I grew more than I ever did and probably ever have in my entire life. I grew closer to God, even though I had less time to work with. My priorities got rearranged, and God made sure I understood this time. You know, some people, you know, a little prompting gets them. Then there are others like me that need the 2 before upside head a few times. And He gave me that. I mean, for a year, you know, I would think that I was going to get a job, going to be able to get out. And the door would close. Same thing would happen again. The door would close. And finally, what I ended up doing is I just went in and I just took a demotion. Just went to stop through. And we were the happiest we'd ever been. That's what suffering can do. God taught me lessons about life and about priorities that I wouldn't have listened to any other way. Our crises, they are not only known by God, but they are important to Him. Whatever we are struggling with, it is intended to empower us and to purify us, to make us a more valuable tool in His kingdom. 4 truths, and then we'll wrap up our study tonight. Suffering develops in us a humble dependence upon God. The examples that we have referred to earlier, Job and Paul, you remember that there was the hand of Satan that was involved in both of those men's lives and those situations. And yet, you and I understand that Satan could only act with the permission of and within the conditions that were established and set by God. That whatever happened in both of those men's lives, ultimately God was the one who was in control. Isn't it comforting to know that every trial that we face, every hardship we experience, comes first through the hands of a God who loves us and who desires our growth? And altering our perspective to see that and to hold on to that will prevent us from lashing out during times of difficulty or in the face of pain, becoming discouraged to the point that we want to throw in the towel and give up. The moment we accept the fact that our ordeal has been at least permitted, if not intended by God, what we do is we equip ourselves to say, Lord, I know that you have allowed or brought this event into my life. And I don't understand it. I don't know the reason why. But I do know that it couldn't happen unless it had been filtered through your loving hands, and therefore I am going to place my trust in you. Job frequently asked the question, why? And yet in 42 chapters of the book that bears his name, the answer to that question is never given, ever. The real point of the book of Job is not a book of suffering. It's a book that teaches us that even in the worst of circumstances, God is worthy of our worship and He is worthy of our trust. That's what Job does at the end of the book. He comes to see God more clearly than he had ever seen God before. And he never would have seen God that way had it not been for the trials that he had to endure. Job trusts more deeply. He depends on God more readily. Look at 2 Corinthians. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8. Paul says this about a trial that he was going through in his life. He communicates it here to the brethren in Corinth. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, let's read verses 8 and 9. 2 Corinthians 1, beginning in verse 8. For we do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. That's not the Paul we typically envision, is it? Despairing of life. Yet Paul says that's where we were. Verse 9, indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, so that we would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. There was a Marine Corps recruiter by the name of Randy Norfleet. He survived the Oklahoma City bombing in spite of losing 40% of his blood and requiring 250 stitches to sew up his wounds. On the way to the hospital, he never lost consciousness because he was too busy thanking God for his survival. When the doctors told him that he was probably going to lose his right eye, his response was, losing an eye is a small thing. Whatever brings you closer to God is a blessing, and through all of this I have been brought closer to God. I am more dependent upon Him and less on myself. You talk about a humble dependence on God even in the midst of horrible circumstances. Suffering has a way of bringing a one day at a timeness to life, doesn't it? It moves us to say, you know, Lord, I can't go on today without your help. Sometimes I can't go on the next hour without your help. Suffering has a way of stripping away all of the distractions, and it forces us to see that we are powerless to change most of the situations that we face in life. And therefore, it is intended to drive us to our Father. It is designed to teach us the importance of the things that are important in life, and to set aside that which is transient and temporal. To develop within us an eternal perspective, to loosen our grasp on the things in this life. A second truth that we need to remember is that progress without pain usually is not possible. We live in a skin-deep world, don't we? That focuses on the external, the superficial, the cosmetic. But things like character and substance are most often developed in a crucible of adversity. You show me someone who hasn't suffered, and I'll show you someone probably who's shallow and superficial. Because unless there's pain in the formula, we typically don't stop long enough and listen hard enough to what God is trying to tell us. That certainly was my case with Publix. We move through life and we think that we're heading in the right direction, only to find out too late that all we've really been doing in life is spinning our wheels. The psalmist wrote in Psalm 119 and verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. I like the way Oswald Chambers phrased it. He said, sorrow burns up a great amount of shallowness. It's a great way of putting it. In our culture, it seems that patience has become the supreme taunt. And we've grown up with a habit of immediacy. We watch as, you know, some of the most challenging problems are solved in an hour television program. We want a pill that, you know, is going to, you know, no matter what malady we have, is going to fix us in the course of a week. We want stuff and we want it now, and a lot of times we get it now. Because that's what everybody else is trying to do as long as we pay them the money for it. They'll try and satisfy our desire for the urgent. And so is it any wonder in our culture that we are undone when we're held in the vice of a prolonged, difficult experience? We're not looking for perseverance. We're not hoping for growth. We just want out. We just want it to end. But the Hebrew writer tells us in chapter 12, verse 11, that wouldn't produce anything good in us. In all three of the passages that we've looked at in detail, there is an urgent theme that appears in big, bold letters. It's the voice of God saying, "My grace is sufficient for you. My strength is perfected in your weakness. You are my son. You are my daughter whom I love. Know what good thing this is producing in you." Third, what you receive depends on how you respond. Go back to, well, we're already here, 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Let's pick up already. Let's go back and read verse 8. This time we're going to read down through verse 10. He said, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, so that we would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a peril of death and will deliver us. He on whom we have set our hope, and he will yet deliver us." You and I, we can struggle against our hardships. We can shake our fists toward heaven. We can blame God, and you will find yourself exhausted and defeated and in despair. Or we can allow the trial to train us and ultimately to strengthen us. And the passages that we've looked at all tell us that if we choose the latter course, that in the process we're going to discover more joy, more power, more holiness, and a lot of times those things can only be purchased with your tears and mine. That God allows no pain without a purpose, but we can only know joy when we set our mind on what it is producing. We can only know power when we abandon our attempts to go at it alone. We can only know holiness when we embrace His discipline. That rather than asking why questions that seem to come so naturally to us, we would be far better off to ask what questions. But what questions don't come as easily, do they? What do you want me to learn from this, Lord? What would you want me to do here, Lord? What changes are you trying to bring about in my life, Lord? Trials have the ability to make us bitter or to make us better. They have the power to lock us into a continued state of spiritual infancy or to press us on to a point of spiritual maturity. To cause significant regression or to cause significant progression. All of that hinges on how we choose to respond. One fellow I was reading behind talked about the fact that when it comes to suffering, you can be a wall or you can be a window. And that phrasing intrigued me a little bit because my initial response is, I want to be a wall. Right? Well, I mean, walls are strong. Walls typically don't fall down. They certainly don't break. You don't throw a rock through one. But the point that he went on to make is that while walls appear to be strong, the problem with walls is that they don't let light through. That a window, even though it appears to be weaker, allows not only the light to shine through them, but it also allows people to see into them. And as people see through the window as you are suffering, God's beauty and God's strength is seen through my weakness. And then finally, it equips us to more effectively minister to others. But one of the most valuable elements of suffering is that it equips us to say to other people with conviction, "I know how you feel. I've been right where you've been." Because understand that when we are in a time of suffering or pain, one of Satan's most effective tools is to make us feel as though we're isolated, that we're the only one who has ever experienced that kind of hurt. But when you've gone through something like that, when you go to them and say, "You know what, I've been where you have been," you can help them to know that they're not alone. that someone else has been where they are and they came out on the other side. And maybe you can throw in some helpful things to get them to that point in time. Let's back up 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Notice verse 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 3. Paul says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our afflictions, so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted." Almost a tongue twister there, isn't it? "For just as the sufferings of Christ are ours in abundance, so also the comfort is abundant through Christ. But if we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation. Or if we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. And our hope for you is firmly grounded, knowing that you are sharers of our suffering, so that you are sharers of our comfort." Now, understand that our pain may not be just about us. It may actually be an effort on the part of God to equip us to minister to somebody who is 5 or 10 years in our future. And God knows that that person is going to need what you or I are going to be able to provide to them as a result of what we are experiencing today. And what that element ought to do really is to emphasize to us again that suffering is not meaningless. It's not without purpose, not for the Christian. That when we allow ourselves to run to the questions that we can't answer, why, or toward things that are uncertain to us, at least at that point in time, what is the immediate purpose of this? We're dabbling in things that we don't know and focusing on questions that we can't answer, and it will only lead to frustration and impatience and hopelessness. But when we remain attentive to the things about suffering that God has told to us, the questions that we can answer, the things that we do know, then circumstances won't appear as daunting or as discouraging to us. I want to close Isaiah chapter 50, verse 10. I'll just quote this one. Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 10. "Who is among you that fears the Lord, that obeys the voice of His servant, that walks in darkness and has no light?" You ever felt there? Who walks in darkness and has no light? "Let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on His God." Sometimes the child of God must walk in darkness, but he keeps on walking. Not because he or she is a glutton for punishment, but because he or she is convinced that being on the right path and staying on the right path is of far greater importance than being able to see the end of the path. Walking in trust, walking by faith, walking in dependence of the one who created us and who loves us so deeply. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, if you're not facing some kind of element of pain or suffering or difficulty in your life, just hang on. It'll come soon enough. And honestly, I don't know how people of the world do it. I don't know how they do that, experience such pain and suffering and difficulty in life without a relationship with God and without the encouragement of a spiritual family. But we don't have to do that. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you don't have to do that. You have a God who loves you, who wants to shape and mold you, and yes, He's going to use suffering at times. I tell people on occasion that being a Christian is one of the most difficult things that anybody can do. But anybody can do it, because God provides us the power. We can help you to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ this evening. Make that need known, won't you? And do so right now while together we stand and sing.